HTF Radio presents the DVD Marquee, sponsored by thehometheaterforum.com and iCraveDVD.com. I'm Jeff Rosato.
And I'm Stan Williams. Thanks for joining us.
What's wrong?
I was having that feeling like deja vu, you know, except for something that hasn't happened.
That was a clip from Final Destination 3, a movie whose absurd title I think guarantees it a spot alongside its predecessor and The Neverending Story 2 in the oxymoronic Hall of Movie Title fame.
And the latest in the successful franchise is the first of five new DVDs we'll be reviewing this week. Mary Elizabeth Winstead from Sky High and The Ring 2 plays Wendy, the most popular gal in her soon-to-be-graduating senior class, a title that starts to dip steeply like a roller coaster at the local amusement park, which, wouldn't you know, just happens to be the locale where this domino of death commences that Wendy sees a coming.
I like that. The domino of death. Is that the opposite of the checkers of life?
I would think so.
Okay.
We have to get off of here. No, don't push the button! Don't push the button! Let me out! Let me out!
Wendy, it's all right.
No, it's gonna crash! It's gonna crash!
Wendy?
The hydraulics will rupture! The dragons will collapse! Please!
What's going on?
Let me off!
Chick's on something.
Right, okay. Given its lukewarm box office take, I didn't really expect much from Final Destination 3, despite the involvement of former television producer James Wan, one of the creative forces behind several classic X-Files episodes. But in bringing the same type of imagination, creativity, and dark humor he applied to that sci-fi classic, Wan comes up with a robust, entertaining film that's a refreshing change from similar chiller franchises whose follow-up installments are often dead on arrival. Though it doesn't reach the height of the original film, Final Destination 3 possesses a lot of the same characteristics. An increasingly intense cycle of deaths, spot-on teenage caricatures, and plenty of black comedy, which might not have been intentional. I'd like to think it is. I hope so. I liked it, Stan. What about you?
Really? First of all, Morgan and Wong, I got a lot of goodwill stored up from the X-Files for them. Really enjoyed the first one. Kind of came out of nowhere. It was kind of a pleasant surprise. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I know what to expect going into Final Destination 3. The whole joy of these movies is watching the whole elaborate Rube Goldberg contraption death scenes.
Right.
You know? And I don't know, this time they just didn't do it for me. It seemed like it's kind of run out of steam. It seemed to get more and more absurd. I think the movie's very well directed. It looks good, it's staged well, and all of that, but I don't know, it just seemed kind of tired.
This is one of those movies where you just got to put your brain on hold. You know,
I hate that. I hate being told to put my brain on hold. I mean, it doesn't have to be Shakespeare, but I don't understand this put your brain on hold thinking for anything. I mean, anything can be good, mindless fun. I certainly understand, you know, where that comes from, but it seems to imply that I'm looking for something great, and I'm not.
I mean, it's a popcorn movie. I mean,
It is.
And you just have to kind of realize that not everything is meant to be excellent. And while this movie is not going to go down on an AFI list, it was fun. You know,
right.
It's only 93 minutes long. It goes by quick. And I just thought it was hilarious.
Okay.
I will tell you that nothing comes close to that unforgettable scene in the first film where Amanda Detmer steps out in the street and she's having this rant about everything that's going on. And not to give anything away, but just let's just say that she didn't follow the old rule of looking both ways before you cross the street.
Right. And the joy in a movie like this is the misdirection. You know, the thinking, you know, here's the big elaborate scene. And it's like you think this is going to happen, but then all of a sudden this comes out of the blue. I have no passion for it one way or the other. I didn't think it was terrible. I ultimately wouldn't recommend it.
Well, I would, and I'll tell you why, because the second disc is probably one of the best supplementally filled discs I've seen in a long, long time.
Here I agree with you. I think even the making of, I think, is even longer than the actual movie itself.
Yeah.
So if you're at all interested in the way movies are made, I mean, I'm a geek for that sort of thing. That stuff I found very interesting.
I also like the Dead Teenager mini-documentary, which features a lot of contributions from Roger Ebert.
That was cool. I especially liked Ebert's story about what Siskel told him, his reaction after seeing the original Halloween. I thought that was a lot of fun. And of course, you know, the big deal they're making about this disc is the whole Choose Your Fate function, which basically, they get to one of the big elaborate death scenes, and, you know, a little option will come up, and you get to choose, and sometimes all it changes is the death just goes in a slightly different way, and other lifetime a character lives. And I thought it was kind of neat. I thought it was well integrated into the movie. I liked the way they had the kind of little carnival atmosphere with the menus and everything.
Right.
And that was fun. Ultimately, again, I didn't enjoy the movie enough to go back and actually play around with every possible outcome, but it was neat. And I think this is something we're going to see a lot more of down the line. And that was a clip from the first season of The Incredible Hulk, which I'm going to go out on a limb and say I think is my favorite Lou Ferrigno TV series of all time. What about you?
And the only one. No, I have really fond memories of The Incredible Hulk. I was never into the comic book or any kind of comic book per se, but I just loved the character of Bruce Banner. I believe it was Bruce Banner for the TV show. No, it was David Banner. And there's an interesting history behind that, which we don't have time to go into. There's a commentary track on the pilot episode in which Kenneth Johnson explains all this for you, probably a lot better than Stan and I can. But the thing that I loved about this show is that it was kind of an anti-superhero show. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've had people like Batman, aka Bruce Wayne, all the psychological stuff. Same thing with Clark Kent and Superman. But David Banner was just an ordinary guy, a scientist who was just really upset over the death of his wife and, you know, had these flashbacks and just wondering if he could have used superhuman strength, you know, the type of strength that people or scientists say we're capable of, but we don't really utilize or know how to utilize. And of course, everybody knows, well, let's just go back to that Ted Cassidy intro, that classic Ted Cassidy. Did you know that Ted Cassidy did the intro for the show?
Really?
From the Addams Family.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Let's let Ted Cassidy set it up.
Dr. David Banner, physician, scientist, searching for a way to tap into the hidden strengths that all humans have. Then an accidental overdose of gamma radiation interacts with his unique body chemistry. And now when David Banner grows angry or outraged, a startling metamorphosis occurs. The creature is driven by rage and pursued by an investigative reporter.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
An accidental explosion took the life of a fellow scientist and supposedly David Banner as well. The reporter thinks the creature was responsible.
I gave a description to all the law enforcement agencies. They got a warrant for murder out of it.
A murder which David Banner can never prove he or the creature didn't commit. So he must let the world go on thinking that he too is dead until he can find a way to control the raging spirit that dwells within him.
It was almost like a fugitive type setup. You know, every week, a different name, a different alias, and this anger within him that came out. Most of the time, it was aimed at people that really deserved to get the crap beat out of them.
Which was always followed by a slow motion sequence of David Banner, or Bruce Banner. I can never keep it straight either.
David.
Of his clothes ripping off. And then Lou
Ferrigno. Instant capri pants.
Lou Ferrigno running around in slow motion every single week. But no, you bring up a good point. I mean, this show definitely did have a, you know, a melancholy to it that I think was sort of unique to TV or movies at the time, at least in terms of superhero, because, you know, we're still talking, you know, 10 years before the Batman movie came out. Got to give props to Bill Bixby. Looking at this, I was really impressed, especially for the time, the sort of performance it was for the time. I mean, we're not talking, you know, Emmy-winning stuff here, but I really admired the guy. Kid, it was one of those shows I watched it every week, but even as like a 10-year-old kid, I was just a little bored with it, and I was really interested to go back and look at this because I haven't seen it probably since its original airing. You gotta love all the 70s cliches. I think the pilot starts off with what the 10-minute flashback sequence that seems to go on and on and on.
Yeah, they could have condensed that. It was too stretched out, and it could have been summarized in an hour or so.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Bill Bixby, I thought, was just perfect for this role.
He was great. And I gotta say, from the pilot, I was really impressed with
Susan Sullivan.
I was really impressed with her. She brought this energy to it that I really liked, and I actually would have liked to have seen a little more with her
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that it wasn't Emmy winning. I've got another bit of trivia for you. It's not on this particular collection. It'll follow up in season two, hopefully, fingers crossed. But Marriott Hartley played in the 2-hour second season premiere and actually won the Emmy for Best Actress.
Huh, I didn't know that.
In 79. Yes, against some pretty formidable competition. To date, it's the only superhero show that has won some sort of recognition from its peers. And I really wish that Bill Bixby would have been included in that as well, because just every week, it just kind of hurt for the guy mm-hmm. because he doesn't want to undergo this metamorphosis, but...
Then, of course, that ending music, you know, that would bum you out, you know, every Friday night as that piano started playing, you know, right before Dallas came on. It was like,
I admit at times it was silly. I mean, there is one episode where Lou Ferrigno's running down the streets of New York with green slippers, you know.
And you can appreciate that on the cheesy level. And I think it's very easy to look back on a show like this through rose-colored glasses. Honestly, I was hoping when I was going through these episodes again that they would hold up a little better than I think they actually have. But let's talk about the DVD.
The only special features are unfortunately recycled from previous releases. You've got a 2003 commentary track with Kenneth Johnson that is so full of energy and recollections from the technical to the personal. One thing I found interesting is that he wanted to use the color of yellow in that opening sequence that you were not too keen about. Mm-hmm. And it represented warmth and it represented heart and love.
There is a lot of that. It is a very energetic commentary. I mean, you can't help but like this guy listening to him. And he obviously came to the table well prepared and mm-hmm. he's excited. He's very enthusiastic about what he's talking about. Even, you know, every now and then it can get a little dry. You know, it's like, well, here's the master shot and here, you know, here's a wide shot and here's a close up. But right. there's a lot of good information in there. And I think anybody interested in this would certainly enjoy listening to it.
And I hope that he'll get a chance to do more in the future box sets, because if this does well, from what I understand, there's going to be a gag reel for season 3. And hopefully they'll be able to unearth some more goodies along those lines. You know, Kenneth Johnson, that name kept reverberating in my head. Where have I heard that from? And I did some research, and it just happens to be the same guy that created the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman. When are those going to come out, Universal? Come on, you know?
Well, if they do bring them out, I hope they do a little better job on the extras, because while this is a good commentary, that's about all you get here. You get that, and you get one episode from season 2, which I wouldn't really consider much of a bonus feature.
Since it's going to be repeated on the next box set.
Exactly. Aside from that, I did think it looked great for its age.
Yes, it did.
Aside from, you know, a little bit of the grain and, you know, some of the dust and stuff you're going to expect from something, you know, a TV show, you know, this old. Colors were very bold. I thought it looked great. And if this is something you've been wanting on DVD, I think you'll be happy with the presentation.
It looks good, and it's got a terrific little 3D-est cover that I know you fanboys like Stan and myself would go gaga over, so...
It's not that cool.
Well, to put it simply, if you love the show as much as I did, you're going to love season 1. Let's keep our fingers crossed for all 4 remaining seasons to make their way on DVD in the not-too-distant future.
I'm proud of you, Ren. You know what's right.
That's right, Stampy.
When you see something's wrong, you don't let it go until you make it right.
Exactly right, Stampy.
Yes, Ren?
Let's do right.
Right.
Well, next month marks the 15th anniversary of the debut of one of the most innovative and controversial cartoons in recent memory, and I'm talking about Ren and Stimpy. About 3 years ago, TNN tried to revive the series with Ren and Stimpy's adult party cartoon, and all I can say is, wow, what a difference 15 years makes, huh?
Well, you know, I kind of had an unusual view of the show. I didn't really like it, but I kind of liked it, you know?
I mean, know exactly what you mean. Even when it first came on in 1991, I mean, I knew people who were just crazy about it. I watched it and I found it funny, like here and there, but ultimately just a little bit too, you know, it was a little too much weirdness for weirdness sakes, I thought.
A show where a dog and a cat pull boogers out of their nose, you know, that's the kind of thing that kind of made me cringe a little bit, you know?
It's all, you know, and this will sound like a weird thing to say, but I guess it's all in the way it's done.
Around that same time, we had Beavis and Butthead, a few years later, South Park, and to be honest, you know, I think it's not too out of the way to say that John Kay may have paved the way for networks to accept shows like that.
Absolutely. He's following on the tradition, I believe, of Ralph Bakshi and some of his work,
right,
you know, in the 70s. And I think today we kind of take it for granted that we get this pretty warped adult stuff, you know, in an animated form, and which I'm crazy about. I mean, I'm an animation nut. Unfortunately, I don't know, looking at these, you know, when it aired on TNN, now known as Spike, you know, I believe they got even more license to go a little bit more adult, and I don't think it helped. Watching this show for me, it was like being trapped on a bus next to a guy, like a really obnoxious guy, telling me dirty jokes the entire way, and
right.
Where you just kind of like laugh uncomfortably just so, you know, maybe he'll leave you alone.
One thing I did like about the old show, the cartoons were briefer. They seemed to be a little bit faster paced, but this time I think they're just a little too long. Once you've seen one double entendre, you've seen them all, and it just seems to get sillier and sillier. I will say that out of the six cartoons here, the best one was one that did not air, according to the research, and that was Naked Beach Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like a Three's Company episode, by far the best out of the six cartoons contained on these two discs.
I think this is all very subjective stuff. Personally, I'm not into bodily function humor. It just doesn't do it to me. And there's a lot of that. Although I do have to say, there's still flashes of brilliance. Every now and then, you know, there's this one thing that really just comes out of the blue and is really funny. And you got to love the energy. You got to admire the style of it. The content just grew old.
Well, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the extras. Could John Kay have been more thorough in these introductions that seemed to go on for hours and hours?
Yeah, and, you know, couldn't the video company, you know, giving them a microphone, perhaps? I mean, yeah. I'm watching this, and here's the guy standing there talking to what appears to be, you know, a home camera, just somebody just set up on a table next to him. You can barely hear him.
Yeah, it's kind of embarrassing if you ask me. I mean, a major product issued by a major company, and it does look like it was done in a rec room of some sort.
Well, I got the impression, though, that was intentional. Like, they're kind of going, oh, look how irreverent we are. You know, we're so cool. We don't really care that we're doing this, but, you know, I'll show up and talk about it anyway. I actually found it a little insulting.
At the same time, I thought it was very nice that the key animators from these cartoons were involved in
that
the
chats. That was cool. That was cool because you don't always get to see these people. You get to see, you know, John Kay, and people tend to think he is the show, you know, right. And it was nice that some of the other animators got to share the spotlight here.
They were a nice substitute for the commentary tracks that weren't included. I'm sure that some fans may have wanted something along those lines, mm-hmm. but some of them went on just a little too long mm-hmm. for, you know, my patience. It's kind of like, okay, let's get on with it, and maybe at the end of it, come back and discuss it a little bit more,
right.
And then we'll move on to the next cartoon.
Right.
We'll set up, blah, blah, blah. But fans of this show, they're not going to give a damn about what we say. They're not going to care. They're just going to eat it up. For those of you that have collected the past season sets that are already out there, if you like your Ren and Stimpy After Dark, you're going to absolutely love Ren and Stimpy Adult Party Cartoon.
You got a car?
No.
I do. It's in the parking lot. It's a 27 convertible. The stuffing is a little bit out of the upholstery, but it runs. I'm off at 11.
Ask the Dust is a 1930s-era tale of romance and racism set in Los Angeles. Written by the Oscar-winning screenwriter Robert Towne, who penned the 1974 classic Chinatown. Based on a highly popular novel, Colin Farrell stars as struggling writer Arturo Bandini, who's filled with a passion for his craft, but suffering a severe case of writer's block. And one might think meeting a beautiful Mexican waitress named Camilla, played by Salma Hayek, would provide an instant muse. But these two wounded souls do nothing but create new emotional scars upon one another.
You think you're so smart? You're gonna write a book and have the world on a string, huh? Well, what if you don't?
I will.
Yeah, but what if you don't?
I will.
You're book smart, but you're not smart. And you're not rich. And you're not nice. You're loud, angry, and poor.
Then why stick around?
Although it had problems, I think this is one of the best movies I've seen so far this year. Being a Puerto Rican descent myself via my father, I really related to a lot of the story. You know, I never faced the kind of racism that Bandini faced, but I knew where he was coming from.
It doesn't surprise me that you would like this. I know it seems to have gotten a bit of a reputation as a disappointing movie, which I guess it is, considering the talent involved. It's nowhere near bad, based on some of the buzz around it. To me, this was just kind of the definition of a two-star movie. It's not really good, but it's not bad either. It's there.
I personally had a problem with the main characters being constantly at each other, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just like, okay, we get the point. You guys have gone through a lot in terms of trying to make your way in America.
It was a little annoying. The whole movie, a lot of the movie felt more like a film play. You know, there's a lot of scenes that take place in, you know, in one room, and I don't know. It just kind of goes to prove, you know, there's no science to movie making. It's got some great acting in it.
Definitely. You know, I've never been a Colin Farrell fan, but he really won me over in this role. I mean, his accent is just beautiful. I mean, there's no trace of his Irish roots.
He is good in this.
And Salma Hayek. I think when many people think of Salma Hayek, they still have this vision of her in From Dusk Till Dawn. And I mm-hmm. think that's kind of stereotyping and condescending in a way, because she's really good in this film as well.
Mm-hmm, she is. You got Donald Sutherland in there also, who to me is always fun to watch in anything.
One performance I got to point out in particular is Idina Menzel. And I hope I'm getting that right. She's the American girl that Arturo meets in the middle of the film. She's a married lady. She loves his writing. And that's one thing that his character seems to want from Camilla.
What did you think of this DVD?
I thought it was beautifully shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cinematography in this was just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, shot by Caleb Deschanel.
Exactly, who also participates on the commentary track mm-hmm. with Robert Towne.
Yeah, the commentary here, I mean, it is a little dry. You know, there are some dead spots here and there. And I mm-hmm. think it really is more kind of, wow, that's Robert Towne and that's Caleb Deschanel, you know, more than you're really interested in what they're actually telling you about the movie, mm-hmm. I think. In addition, there's also about a 14-minute making of, which is kind of so-so. It's kind of along the lines of your basic studio promotional material. Nothing major there.
You know, there's nothing worse than a generic, almost kind of HBO feel to mm-hmm. these making ofs. And I have to admit, I was kind of disappointed with this particular feature because, you know, I wanted more depth to it, mm-hmm. more inside stuff. But it's not bad for what it is.
If you're a Colin Farrell fan, or if you're a Salma Hayek fan, I think you'll find something in there to enjoy. An ambitious movie that didn't quite reach its goals, but is still not as bad as its reputation may have you believe.
And how often do you get to hear Robert Towne on the commentary track? So, there you go.
You're the replacement for the bass and sax?
That's us. And I'm Daphne. This is Joe Zavine.
Hello. I'm Sugar Kane.
Hi.
Sugar Kane?
Yeah, I changed. It used to be Sugar Kowalczyk.
You Polish?
Yes. I come from this musical family. My mother is a piano teacher. My father was a conductor.
Where did he conduct?
On the Baltimore in Ohio.
Oh.
The unmistakable voice of Marilyn Monroe from Some Like It Hot, a film that topped AFI's Top 100 Comedies list of a few years back. But how does it play to modern-day audiences? Stan, what did you think of this Billy Wilder classic?
First of all, I had never seen it before. You know, when a movie is named the funniest movie of all time, those are some pretty big shoes to fill, you know? I watched it, really enjoyed it. Did I think it was the funniest movie of all time? No.
You know, it's not a consistent laugh-out-loud comedy, and in a way, I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that the laughs are spaced out. There's a story here. I think we're so used in these modern-day times with, you know, it's got to be bang, 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 you know, quick shot, quick edit, quick cut, and we've forgotten how much timing played a role
Absolutely.
In these old movies.
Absolutely. You know? And that was something I was trying to get to. As a modern moviegoer, you know, if you're going to this for the first time, you've really got to look at it in context. And to jump ahead a little bit, I mean, that's where the extras really shine, I think, on this thing. Because, you know, I was looking at the extras and, you know, you have Lowell Gans and Babalu Mandel, you know, on the commentary track
right.
talking about the structure of the screenplay. And it is one of those things. It's like once you hear the, you know, the people involved talking about it, you know, it is kind of like, wow, you know, I didn't really pick up on that. It's one of the rare times where the special features actually made me want to go back and watch the movie again with a whole new appreciation of it.
Complete agreement there. You know how much I love Jack Lemmon. I mean, this guy was just like a bundle of energy. And to think that they almost cast Frank Sinatra in this role. I don't think it would have worked. It wouldn't have been the same movie.
Oh, I don't either.
As much as I love Sinatra, I would like to think that even Frankie Baby probably said, oh, thank God I didn't show up for that meeting with Billy Wilder. You know, thank goodness I stood him up, because Jack Lemmon, you can't picture anybody else in this particular role. I mean, he's just an absolute riot.
This is one of those movies where, you know, I wish I had been around in 1959 to experience it when it was fresh. This whole DVD, it's a classic cinema lover's nirvana. I think some of the stuff on here is just invaluable, especially in your appreciation for the film if you weren't around, you know, the first time it came around, because just the way they put it into context, how, you know, one little thing here was so controversial at the time, and, you know, so much of what's in this movie, I think, which, you know, would probably diminish the impact for a modern audience,
right,
has been imitated so many times that, of course, you know, the impact is going to be a little dull. We've seen everybody in drag, well, not everybody in drag, I mean, nothing personal, but I don't care to see you in drag. But we've seen so many actors and so many comedians in drag by now that it's old hat. And, you know, you have to kind of rewire your brain, you know, to look at it in that context.
Back in 1959, this was kind of a groundbreaking thing. About the only thing I can remember is Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye in White Christmas, you know, when they were trying to elude the cops, you know, and they kind of got dressed up in those little hair bows and what have you and had the feathers and all that. But they didn't go all the way. I mean, Jack and Tony, you know, did everything from the high heels to the hats on the top of their heads, you know. And by the way, how about a little love for Tony Curtis in this movie? I mean, we've heard about Marilyn Monroe. We've heard about Jack Lemmon. But Tony Curtis is just absolutely a gem in this movie.
Absolutely. The whole, the Cary Grant imitation he does. The way that it's Cary Grant, but just not quite. It's like if Cary Grant got punched in the face a few times.
And, you know, of course, he's also great as Josephine. Although, did you know that they kind of had to tweak his voice a little bit with that of Paul Frees, the infamous animation voiceover guy that did Rocky and Bullwinkle, I believe, and, you know, a bunch of cartoon shows back in the 1960s and 70s. Even with the enhancement, just his looks alone, the way he purses his lips, I mean, just literally kills me. I just go into a fit of laughter every time. You know, sometimes I can't even hear Lemon's dialogue because I'm looking at him and just I'm dying, you know?
It literally killed you.
Yes, it did.
You are now dead.
A moment of silence. But you know where I'm coming from. You know, I loved it. This movie would have had the luck to come out the same year as Ben-Hur, Guys in Chariots over Guys in Drag. And we all know Chariots over Guys in Drag is going to win out. You know, they're going to get the votes of the peers. But anyway, I digress. But
we face that every day. We all know what it's like, Guys in Chariots over Guys in Drag.
True. And I'm so glad that you liked the extras on this disc. And a lot of it is new. It's not a carbon copy of the original disc. And for starters, it is 16:9. And I still can't believe that the original release was not anamorphic. It still shocks me. One of the greatest films of our time. They didn't even bother to remaster it properly. I can tell you that it looks a lot clearer. It's more film-like. It just looks beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
It really does look fantastic.
Let's talk about the new stuff first. You've got the new documentary, The Making of Some Like It Hot, which we just talked about, The Legacy of Some Like It Hot, and a new full-length commentary featuring interviews with Tony Curtis, Babalu Mandel, and Low World Gans, like you mentioned. I'll tell you the cool thing about the documentaries that I loved. All our lives, we've heard about Billy Wilder. We've seen still photographs of him, but he rarely gave interviews. And how cool is it to actually see the man with that wonderful accent for the very first time?
He's one of those guys you could just sit there and listen to him talk forever. He's just that entertaining no matter what he's talking about.
There's a part where Jack Lemmon is talking about Billy Wilder, and he's trying to do Billy's accent, and he goes, I'm not even sure that Billy can do Billy's accent. I mean, just, I love that.
It's just great stuff. This is a movie, I mean, to watch, to enjoy, and to study. If you're a fan, I'm sure there's a lot of new stuff in there for you. If you're like me, you're just now getting on the bandwagon. A lot of great information in this. Just the interview with Tony Curtis. There's just a sweet quality. There's just that whole old Hollywood thing where any of these people are interesting to listen to. There's no shortage of stories, you know, that are entertaining and fascinating to listen to.
If you're a fan of classic movies, or if you just want to say, hey, I've got all those AFI movies in my cabinet, you gotta have have this one. It is definitely a cinematic classic. Marilyn Monroe, Tony Curtis, Jack Lemmon, directed by the wonderful Billy Wilder. Some Like It Hot in a brand new 2-disc collector's edition from MGM and Sony. And folks, that is going to put the lid on another DVD marquee show. We thank you so much for listening.
Hey, Jeff, will you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Will you play the sad walking away music from the Hulk?
Why, of course, Stan.
Okay, I'm walking away.
Folks, that does it for another edition of the DVD Marquee.
I'd like to stay, but I gotta go.
As usual, we'd like to thank thehometheaterforum.com.
Gotta leave town, came in, stay at the school, Marn. Gotta go.
iCraveDVD.com.
Sticking up with them.
And of course, you for listening. For Stan Williams, I'm Jeff Rosato. Until next time.
Trying to hitch a ride, showing a little leg.